You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 124, and Pipefitters, Local 533. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEWLocal124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. And the Pipefitter powers the engines of industry that keep business thriving in America. They install, maintain, and service any system that involves air conditioning, heating, chemicals, or refrigeration in residential, commercial, or industrial buildings, as well as high-tech clean rooms. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, we're going to hear from middle school kids who will be talking about labor history. And then Bill Fletcher has a novel. It's called The Man That Fell from the Sky. And we're going to be talking to Bill about his first effort at a novel. In the news, is the new NAFTA any better than the old one? And postal workers will hit the streets to fight privatization. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Ario. She'll be talking about how the U.S. Department of Agriculture is going to permit raising line speeds in poultry plants. Wonderful. And deaths in the coal industry. Well, that'll be cheery, but whatever. Now for the news.
News from our side, October 4th, 2018. The Trump administration has taken aim at the U.S. Postal Service, proposing changes that threaten to destroy the important role of our public postal system plays for all Americans. In May, President Trump created a task force to evaluate USPS operations and finances. The executive order creating the task force suggests that USPS's universal service obligation, which requires to deliver to every address in the nation for the same low prices, is no longer necessary. The postal unions say nothing could be further from the truth. In the age of e-commerce, mail order prescriptions, and voting by mail, affordable universal service is more important than ever. While the task force has yet released its findings, the administration tipped its hand in the Office of Management and Budget's government-wide reorganization plan, which was released in June. Most notably, the plan called for eventual privatization. What would privatization mean? The four unions that represent the workers think small and medium-sized American businesses will be harmed, consumers will pay more, and service to rural areas will be cut. Postal workers' jobs, which currently pay a living wage with benefits, will be replaced with bad jobs. Elections, which rely more and more on mail ballots, would be compromised. The unions have organized a rally for next Monday demanding the U.S. mail is not for, demanding the U.S. mail is not for sale. It's in front of Union Station at 300 Pershing Road in Kansas City from 10 a.m. to noon.
Now that Trump has forced agreement with Mexico and Canada on a revised NAFTA, unions in the Citizens Trade Campaign, made up of many anti-free trade organizations, are studying the text and issuing statements. The Citizen Trade Campaign's executive director, Arthur Stamoulis, said the Trump administration's current NAFTA proposal fails to include the critical changes necessary to protect jobs, raise wages, defend human rights, and reverse environmental damage. Substantial additional changes are needed if the pact is going to provide real benefits to people other than corporate elites. Most unions are still studying the pact, whose name will be changed to USMCA. One change for the good is the elimination of the investor-state dispute settlement, or ISDS, rules with Canada and weakening them to only a handful of capital-intensive industries with Mexico. This is the system that let arbitration panels of pro-corporate trade attorneys overturn laws in their respective countries. But many labor unions are still studying the mixed bag of changes, Richard Trumka, AFL-CIO president, said. Our history of witnessing unfair trade deals destroy the lives of working families demands the highest level of scrutiny before receiving our endorsement. The addition of a new labor chapter will, for the first, is actually incorporate labor rights into the body of the agreement, but it's not at all clear that there are sufficient enforcement mechanisms. Canada had proposed a ban on right-to-work laws in the U.S. in the labor chapter, but that's been removed. And for Mexican workers to enjoy real rights to organize and bargain, there will need to be changes made in their labor laws. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard said, "The effort to achieve the goal of a fair trade agreement that protects workers in the United States, Canada, and Mexico is far from over. There are provisions in the draft agreement between the United States and Mexico that represent improvements over NAFTA, but there are also provisions that must be removed." The steelworkers are also unhappy that the new agreement continues the 25% tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum, while the Teamsters president, James P. Hoffa, is guardedly optimistic that the new agreement will impose new restrictions on Mexican trucks roaming all over U.S. roads. Meanwhile, organizations of Mexican small farmers are hopping mad at President-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador for agreeing not to insist on either restoring Mexican farm subsidies or eliminating U.S. ag subsidies. The NAFTA provisions, which bankrupted small farmers in Mexico and created the wave of desperate migrants fleeing to the U.S.
PAI Labor News reported on one really good part of the new NAFTA replacement. However, it's tucked away in a footnote in the labor chapter. It says that the new agreement includes the right to strike. Section 3 of Labor Chapter 23, written into the pact, says all three countries shall adopt and maintain the following rights: A, freedom of association and the right to collective bargaining. Freedom of association has footnote. Collective bargaining has footnote 6. Footnote 5 reads, for greater certainty, the right to strike is linked to the right to freedom of association, which cannot be realized without protecting the right to strike. Footnote 6 refers to an annex which sets out obligations with regards to worker representation in collective bargaining. So we wonder, if this stays in the agreement, will it mean that public employees, most of whom are banned from the striking in the U.S., will finally get paid full labor rights?
And finally, our Walmart points out that Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos makes $4 million an hour. Still, it's no small matter that he just raised his workers' pay to $15 an hour. This is the result of a long campaign in which more than 100,000 people signed a petition demanding that Bezos give his workers a raise. Senator Bernie Sanders, who's been a harsh critic of Amazon's wage and employment policies and of Bezos, issued a statement thanking Bezos for doing the right thing. He's now moving on to demand that Walmart, McDonald's, and the fast food industry, the airline industry, and the retail industry in general start paying their workers a living wage, at least $15 an hour. Sanders said, When I talk about the political revolution, people standing up in their communities and at their workplaces and fighting for change, I mean exactly what the Amazon workers and people everywhere did to achieve this victory. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Christina Dismang, Jen Zaman, Kyla Rafferty, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Mother Jones is dead and gone, she could no longer stay. No one knew how old she was, but she was often heard to say how she was born in 1830 in the sweet County Cork. But she crossed the foaming billows till she landed in New York. Mother Jones, the miner's angel, must be treated with respect. She's an old-fashioned lady, and you never would suspect that this gown and this bonnet would fill the rich man full of dread. She's the most dangerous woman in America, they said. I see her marching down the street with her umbrella in her hand.
Tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum, we will be discussing with local 7th grade students about the history of child labor and its implications in our world today. And what's interesting about this discussion that we're going to have today is in 7th grade in Kansas City, not all schools, but many of our 7th graders take geography and economics in 7th grade. However, very few actually come with the background knowledge of labor history or labor in general, what it means and basically what it means for them and their families. Now, there's a lot of times in our education, unfortunately, students can go through their kindergarten through 12th grade education without ever discussing labor once. So as a teacher, as specific 7th grade, I was thinking about how can I apply this to my classroom. I teach economics, a perfect segue to teach about labor in the classroom, and I discuss with my advanced class, advanced geography and economics class about their knowledge on labor and decide to expand on it. But first off, I asked them, what were they interested in learning about? And my students, after looking through a few articles, decided that child labor and sweatshops were what they were most interested about. So tonight's discussion will be going around the history of child labor and also what it means for our students today and also their opinion on how they can become more active.
All right, thank you so much for joining us. Could you introduce yourselves?
I'm Samantha.
I'm Madison.
All right, well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Well, first off, we're going to talk about child labor, the history of child labor, and its implications today. So the very first question I'm going to be asking is, can you guys first tell me what is child labor?
Child labor is when businesses use children as a workforce.
And do we see that a lot today here in the United States?
No.
It was more something of the past. So first off, could someone tell me a little bit about what child labor laws were like before we had them?
People had children work for them and give them barely any money. There were more hospitals than schools. Kids got hurt and sometimes died. And paying children was cheaper than paying adults.
And was that necessarily right?
No, not at all.
Not at all. So do you think they got a lot of opportunities for education?
No.
No.
They probably didn't get good jobs in the future.
No, kind of keeping that cycle of poverty going. So, but first of all, we're going to talk about a famous person within child labor and labor history in general. Can you tell me a little bit about who Mary Harris Jones was?
Mary Harris Jones lost her family to yellow fever. She moved to Chicago and started a just manufacturing business. Her business was destroyed in the Chicago fire of 1871. She was labeled the most dangerous woman in America because she also became an advocate of ending child labor, and she witnessed children working long hours in textile mills.
All right. And also, what did she become known as?
She became known as Mother Jones.
So one of the most famous female figures within labor history has a connection to child labor. And also there's someone else, Lewis Hine. Can you please tell me, how did Lewis Hine's photographs change the way people looked at child labor?
He took photographs of children next to large machinery equipment. His photographs were published, letting the world know of the harsh working conditions.
So people were finally able to see photographs of children working with large machinery equipment. So do you think that changed people's minds?
Yes, a lot.
Why do you think so?
Because, like, right now there's, like, less child labor in the world than there was back then.
So because maybe back at one point in time there wasn't a lot of visualizations, and when they finally had those photographs, people could finally see what was happening, right?
Yep.
Next off, can someone tell me, so finally you have these photographs that are coming out. You have Mother Jones doing a big push against child labor. What was the first child labor law?
Connecticut was the first state to pass a wage and hour law for children in 1842. New Jersey followed in 1851. But the first federal child labor law was passed in 1916.
And that was the Keaton-Owen labor law?
Mm-hmm.
So Connecticut was the very first one, then you had New Jersey. But what was different between that and the federal law? What's different about federal law?
Well, the federal law is nationwide, and the Connecticut and New Jersey law was more for that state than it was nationwide.
So there have been child labor laws around for a while, but it wasn't nationally recognized until... What year?
1916.
It wasn't recognized until 1916. All right. I guess it wasn't until 1922 whenever official labor law was passed by Congress. So we're going to be moving for a little bit more in time to 1937. Madison, can you tell me a little bit more about the Fair Labor Act, Standards Act of 1937?
It forbidden children under the age of 18 from working around machinery that is dangerous. This act takes the account of four requirements of the school year. This act regulates hours used work from 14 and up.
From 14 ages and up. So it's interesting on what's considered child labor laws. What do you think, what age is good for children to start working? What age?
I say like around 17.
Around 17?
So they can like get some money while they're still in like school, if they're still in school, so they can move on to college.
So they can save up money and not rely on their parents, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Samantha?
I think somewhere around 16 and 17 because they could save up enough money to buy a new car, and then also they can save more money to go to college and buy all the necessities they need and like buy a new apartment so they don't have to stay in a dorm room.
All right, good. And so when we look at the history of child labor laws, I want you guys to think about what are some of your thoughts about the history of child labor laws. And
in California and New Mexico, you still have children working in farms.
And however, but that's still a small minority compared to the rest of the United States, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But is it like that around the rest of the world?
No, because around the rest of the world, most children usually gotta go to work and like have to work for their family, and like their parents also work too, so they can make enough money to buy all the food and necessities they need for that week or day. Because usually they can't buy more than a few items because they get so much money.
No, that good example. I know we've talked about the fincas before in Guatemala, but I know, Madison, you also had a few more examples that you learned about as well.
China Mexico, Honduras, Vietnam, El Salvador, they have child labor. And Nike is one of the main causes of it, because...
Are they the only cause?
No, but they're one of the main ones, because they do make a lot of money, and they don't pay their workers enough, and they have some children work over there.
And do they pay their workers enough here in the United States?
Yeah. They pay them enough so that way they can buy, like, food and the necessities they need for a while.
But what about their workers that they contract out in other countries?
They don't, because they get paid like $4 or $5 a day.
Sometimes less. Because they also sometimes like have the workers stay in a disgusting place, like a small concrete little house. And then like when you go use the restroom, it just like flows outside and you can see it. And then it overflows when it rains. And it comes to the door.
And you learned about, do you remember what country that was in?
Indonesia.
Also, but Nike's not the only one. There's other companies around the world. Because what do we like here in the United
States?
Cheap
clothes.
Yeah, we like cheap clothes here in the United States. And do you think we can get cheap clothes if we're, since we have labor laws here in the United States that pay people at a decent wage, do you think that we can have the same cheap clothing?
No.
We
get different cheap clothes.
And let's also talk about opportunities. Since we have child labor laws here in the United States, and there's places around the world which our manufacturing is exported to, and they don't have child labor laws, what things are those children workers missing out on?
They're missing out on their education and a life to live because they're stuck in, like, factories and making stuff instead of being outside and playing with, like, other children and going to school and learning about, like, social studies and math.
And geography. You can't forget geography.
Exactly right. And what else do you think they're missing out on?
They're missing out, like, having
They're missing out on their
friends.
Childhood.
They're missing out on having friends, playing with their friends, maybe like going to parks and stuff with their family, like, and maybe like wearing like nicer clothes and stuff.
Yeah, good. And also, I want you guys to think about, we know all about this now. We know about the child labor history here in the United States. Now we know that there's, even though it's for the most part, we don't see it here anymore, but there's other places in the world that have child labor.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think people your age can do about it to make other people aware?
We could make it aware to people that children are working instead of going to school and having a life. So that way, like, we could work on getting child labor laws
like
in other places.
Like around the whole world, no working children. Just let them work on school and life. And we could also put up posters or something like that.
So visualizations, because remember whenever we were talking about the photographs that Lewis Hines put into the newspaper?
Yeah.
What did that do? When he put that in there, what did that help?
It helped change how child labor was looked at, because like people saw the children, and the people started like, get sense, like, I don't think the children should be messing with that type of stuff, and, like, they could probably die from it or something.
So it's about awareness, right? Making
mm-hmm.
people aware. So other senses, so maybe, for instance, looking at, what do you guys think about people being aware of what clothing they're wearing? So
yeah.
Wearing, what clothes do kids wear here at the school?
Uniforms.
Oh yeah, uniforms. But also, what brands?
Polo.
So wear polo.
Cat and Jack.
What else? What type of shoes do people always wear?
Adidas.
Vans. Nike.
Jordans. So making, showing images of what people are wearing and where that's coming from, right?
Mm-hmm.
What else can you guys think of that can help also bring awareness? What about you guys? Tell me, what did you just recently do? What activity did you just work on here?
We made posters about sweatshops around the world.
Yeah, in our geography class that you teach. And we got to read about that place, about the sweatshop, and write about it on, like, a card, and then, like, and put some, like, how much they make hourly, daily, weekly, and annually. And we put, like, comments down and how old the workers are.
And then what did you guys make?
We made a poster. A map.
Yeah. What type of map was it?
Special purpose.
Yes, a special purpose map to show what?
To show
where our stuff comes from around the world.
So where our stuff is coming from around the world. And do you think that's part of awareness as well? Because where is it out right now?
Outside Everywhere. The door.
It's outside your door.
Yeah.
In the hallway where people see it.
So when they pass by, they can see what?
See our special purpose maps and what is importing and exporting from different countries to our country, or what we're exporting to other countries.
Okay, good. And then last thing I'm going to ask you guys, what are your final thoughts about what you've learned?
Well, I just think it's, like, really, really unfair that children, like, my age and stuff have to go to work to fend for their family and, like, make clothes and stuff like that, but, like, they should be outside and working and everything and stuff like that. Like, they shouldn't be in a factory. They should be in school, like, getting an education that they need.
And I hope that child labor would end, because it is still happening around the world as we speak. And I agree with Samantha, because it's not fair for the children, because, like, they won't probably get a good job once they grow up, because they already were, like, because people will say, you don't have an education, sorry, goodbye. And people don't care or don't want to get hurt, but look at the kids. The kids work every day trying to stay alive, trying to help their families, and if it goes unrecognized, it will get worse. If we don't stop child labor, who knows what's going to happen? Take Nike, for example. They pay people less than $1 per hour and sell thousands and sell what they make for thousands of dollars, but pay them around $1 for making it. Kids struggle to stay alive, and people don't see that. It is not right. These kids should be getting an education, but instead they have to work. They probably don't have friends. Child labor needs to stop. I would do anything for there to be no child labor or any type of, based on an article I read.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
No problem. Thank you.
Most times, KKFI moves against the stream, but just saying play KKFI to your smart speaker will bring our stream to you, KKFI, wherever you are.
Hello, this is Martha Lally, producer of KKFI 90.1 FM's Anything Goes show with Charles Ferrugia and Carol Jean Barta. Hey, Carol. We're going to have Steve Noel on the show to talk about his 40 historic Kansas City mansions book coming out.
It's called The Houses of Kansas City from 1885 to 1930. Most of these are haunted. Well, I don't really know that personally.
Decide for yourself on the next Anything Goes show.
Fridays at noon.
KKFI is volunteer powered, but relies on financial support from the community. You can share information about your organization or event with our supporters when you become a community marketing partner. Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing. Thank you.
And that was John Coltrane's Velvet Scene. Good evening and welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi. In this second half, we're going to be talking with Bill Fletcher about his latest book, The Man Who Fell from the Sky. Longtime racial justice, labor, and international activist, scholar, and author, Bill has been involved in the labor movement for decades. He's widely known as a speaker and writer in print, radio, television, and the web. And he's served in senior staff positions with many prominent union and labor organizations, including the Service Employees International Union, the National AFL-CIO, and the American Federation of Government Employees. He's also former president of Trans-Africa Forum. The author of They're Bankrupting Us, Beacon Press 2012 and Solidarity Divided, UC Press 2009, departed from his more scholarly academic nonfiction work on race and class to bring us this exciting crime fiction novel set in New England. Bill, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
I'm really pleased to be here. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. You know, Bill, the last time that we spoke, I think that it was at a celebration of Jerry Tucker's life in St. Louis. That was probably, 5 years ago?
Yes. My God, it's amazing how time has passed, and I still miss Jerry as much as I did then.
Me too. And I have to say, and I hope that I'm not outing myself here, but the only one who's actually able to help me understand about right to work, and we've had all these battles going on here in Missouri, was you. So I think you just absolutely convinced me of the rightness of winning the right to work stuff. And so I wanted to appreciate you. I wanted to tell you that I appreciate you and your work and that you've done for labor and social justice over the years.
Thank you. I'm honored.
Okay. So right before I got here, I was actually showing my son. We were driving to the studio, and I showed my son, Julian, I'm going to be interviewing this guy. This is Bill Fletcher, and we were looking at a YouTube video of you at the UN talking about the Palestinian situation at the United Nations. I said, I'm going to be interviewing this guy. And we sat and listened to it, and he goes, my gosh, Dad, this is great history that he's talking about here. This is so deep. And then here, I'm looking at a piece of what seems to be like a Stephen King crime genre fiction. What brought you to fiction, Bill?
Oh, what a question. You know, I've always been intrigued with mysteries and science fiction, and found in both genres an incredible room to explore ideology, to explore history. In a way that can be very popular. But, you know, the thing that I would say, and I've said this to other people, is that there's really two points in terms of what drove me in this direction. One is this feeling of having an itch that I had to scratch. There was a story in me that I simply had to write, and I just did eventually. When I was able to convince myself that it was legitimate.
Sure.
The other thing is that I have found that all of us have stories. And I've talked to a lot of people who really want to write. They feel guilty about it. Sometimes they don't think that they're good enough. And I point out to people that we all have stories. I don't mean just personal stories. I mean stories that we've put together in our heads that we'd like to somehow express, like a good piece of music.
Yeah.
And so I just decided I had to do it. And it's not that I didn't have other things to write, but I felt I just needed to write it.
You know, I think that sentiment is shared by the publisher of Hardball Press. We've talked before, and we've actually reviewed some of his books here on the Heartland Labor Forum, the Lenny Moss Mysteries. And he said as well that working class people have stories to tell, and that there's not much of a market. There is a market for it. There is a niche for it, but it just seems to be an underserved segment of the population. So. It's interesting that you decided, you know, it's a story that you could have told in a nonfiction form. but you decided to use fiction as instead. I just thought that that was really interesting.
Yeah, first of all, to go back to the beginning of your point, one thing that's important for your listeners to appreciate is how difficult it is to get things published, and particularly fiction. And there is a high degree of elitism in the publishing world. There are great difficulties for unknown fictional writers or writers of fiction. And you have to fight. I mean, after writing the manuscript and getting the go-ahead from my wife, my daughter, a cousin of mine, and a good friend who said I really should proceed, I went to find an agent. And I could not find an agent. I went to several and was just blown off. And it was only by accident that I ran into the publisher, Tim Sheard of Hardball Press, at an event where I was giving a talk, and we started chatting. He asked me what I was up to, and I told him about this. One thing led to another, and that's how it happened.
I was curious about that. I was curious if you had some sort of relationship with Hardball Press before and that this was sort of a joint effort, or if this was something that you were working on before, and it sounds like this is something that's kind of been on your mind for a while.
Yes. I had met Tim before, but we hadn't been in touch. I made an attempt at writing a novel back in 2007, 2008. Had a great time writing it, but it didn't work out. And I was sort of discouraged, but then I had this new idea, which ultimately became The Man Who Fell from the Sky. Mm-hmm. And I worked it out in my head over about 5 years. And then I took about 3 months and wrote it. And then, as I said, I gave it to my wife, my daughter, cousin of mine and a good friend, and I said, look, I don't want you to edit this. I want you to look at this. I want you to read it and give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down. That's it. If you think it is worth proceeding, give me a thumbs up. If you think this is not going to make it, it was a nice try, Bill, give me a thumbs down. Don't worry about my feelings because I had a lot of fun writing this. Mm-hmm. So either way, it's okay. And all four gave me a thumbs up.
Ah, that's great. Yeah. So we were talking about the process of getting it written, and you mentioned another novel before. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about if you can talk to our listeners about sort of the process of writing, because I'm sure some of our listeners here, like you said, have these stories inside of their head. They're thinking about, well, what do I do with this? You know, how do I even get it out of my head and onto paper? Can you tell us a little bit about your process? I mean, even the technology you use.
Well, the process starts with dreaming. And dreaming while you're awake. It started with, in both cases, an idea. A very basic idea, something that I thought might be interesting. So let me focus on The Man Who Fell from the Sky.
Yeah.
In this novel, what I was trying to do was to explore a transitional moment in the history of Cape Verdean Americans. And many people don't know who Cape Verdeans are, but they were the first post-1492 African population to migrate voluntarily to the United States. And they started coming from the then-Portuguese-controlled islands of the Cape Verde Archipelago, which is about 500 miles off the coast of Senegal. And they started coming as whalers and fishermen, and then they migrated for other reasons, including climate issues, because there's droughts that really hit Cape Verde. And they started settling in the New England area. Over time, they spread out. But they were a African population, spoke Portuguese, mainly Roman Catholic, and they were from a colony. So they didn't come as slaves. And they so they had a certain identity set of identity issues that were very complicated. What were they? Were they Portuguese?
Uh-huh.
If they called themselves, if they saw themselves as black, in the minds of some of them, they thought that that meant they were the descendants of slaves, and they refused to accept that. So there was this constant ideological struggle among Cape Verdeans about who they were, their relationship to African Americans, their relationship to Portugal, to their own homeland. And in the 1960s, late 50s, early 60s, a war of liberation against Portugal starts in Guinea-Bissau and the Cape Verde, both controlled by Portugal. Mm-hmm. And through this national liberation war, there's a change in consciousness that starts among, that really advances among Cape Verdeans. This affects Cape Verdeans in the United States at the same time that the Black Freedom Movement in the United States is raising these incredibly powerful issues about Black power, Black consciousness. So the book, so what I wanted to do was to look at this transitional moment and what was going on and you know, how the consciousness of the Cape Verdeans were changing and some of the challenges. So I started with that idea. And then I was also affected by a story I'd heard about an incident that took place in World War II with the killing of an African-American soldier. So I fused these together. Now, one of the things for the listeners is once you start with a basic story, then you have to start thinking through through your mind's eye, you have to start thinking about the characters, and you have to basically, it's like designing a map. You know, where are you starting, and where do you want to end up? And then along the way, what are some of the key moments, the moments of excitement and interest? The other thing that's important in writing fiction, which was a real challenge, because as you know, in the beginning, I mainly write nonfiction,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that what you see in your mind's eye has to be translated onto paper.
Right.
And therein lies a philosophical difference among fiction writers about how much detail to put. So, for example, anyone that's read any of the Stieg Larsson books, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Excellent.
The first three were written by him, which I loved. He goes into tremendous detail, and I loved it. It appealed to me. My publisher, however, even though he enjoyed the books, he said to me, too much detail.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So there are these differences within the realm of fiction about what level of detail, but you have to remember when you're writing fiction that you have to create enough for the reader so that they, too, can envision the scene, mm. that they can, in my case, they can get to know David Gomes, mm. the main character in the story, mm. and what he looks like, how he dresses, his complicated relationship with his girlfriend, and, you know, his coming to grips with family issues. Mm. And so it's sort of like drawing a map. Some people, I remember the author of The Born Identity, whose name is Robert Ludlum. Mm-hmm. Robert Ludlum said that before he wrote any fiction, he would write a long outline. And as soon as he finished the outline, he would throw it out and then start writing the book. And in my case, I worked through the outline in my head, then made some notes, and then I just started writing. And I just had a great time.
Was there any point in getting this book written or in the process of writing it that you were surprised? Because I also do some writing, but what I found in even listening to other authors and fiction writers just talking about their process, do you ever find that the fiction sort of takes over? Like, it's no longer you sort of creating these characters, but these characters are sort of taking your hand and making you write their story in a way that you never even imagined.
Absolutely. I mean, I had heard that happened. You know, same as you, and I'd heard that from other writers. And all of a sudden it was happening with me. It's like I'm typing, and it's like, where are these ideas coming from?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, for example, there was a... When I wrote the first draft, there was a plot line that involved an affair.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I'm writing this. It was not in my original idea. It was not. But all of a sudden, it's like my fingers took over. I eventually, you know, got rid of that particular plot line for a variety of reasons. But another time that it came up was that there was a character that your readers, your listeners will hopefully see if you have the opportunity of reading the book.
Mm-hmm.
There's a security guard at a building. And this security guard, he's in the lobby of this building. He's, you know, he was someone who was not in my original thinking.
Mm.
But when I was writing about David Gomes going into this particular building, all of a sudden, this character appeared. And when he appeared, what was funny is that I knew exactly what he looked like. Exactly what he looked like.
Yes.
And how he sounded. And it was just, it was there. He was there. And it was almost as if he was alive.
It's so funny. I can just picture that... you know, some of these characters just kind of coming to life, and then you can almost see like what their next words are. Again, like you said, what they're wearing, mm-hmm. what they smell like, what they eat. And I was struck by what you were saying. We've got about 3 minutes left, but I was struck by what you were saying about the verisimilitude and like what it means for these certain seemingly minor things you wouldn't include in nonfiction that is included in fiction in order to sort of create this world. And I saw in your writing when, you know, the coffee that Gomes shares with the guy that owns the model the hobby model store.
Oh yeah, Hank.
Hank, great. Yeah, Hank.
Great. Hank, great.
Ketchup for some reason seems to play a role in this story. There's mm-hmm. the hot dogs and the lunches that are shared between the detective and the
sure.
and the news reporter and
clams.
Yeah, and the cups of coffee mm-hmm. and like all of these just little things that just make it make these characters believable. So like if David Gomes was going to do a thing that was out of character, we absolutely would have known it because he has certain traits and characteristics that he just can't really act outside of those things. There's so much more that I'd love to get into. I'd love to get in. There's a certain part in the book on page 158 that kind of goes into we figure out like who the man is that fell from the sky. I'd love to get into that. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to. If our readers or if our listeners want to find out kind of what this book is about, who these characters are, and get into a really engaging crime novel, they're really in for a treat. Where could they?
Thank you.
If people want to find this book, where can they go?
Two places. Hardball Press has a website. You can order it directly through them,
mm-hmm.
or you go to Amazon.
Okay.
And the other thing is that I'm hoping to do, not hoping, I will be doing book events around the country beginning November 18th. The first one will be in Washington, D.C. And so I'm looking for invitations to travel around the country. I have two or three for New York City in December. And then in 2019, going to do quite a number. I want to definitely hit New England, and I'd like to get to the Midwest. I'd love to be, you know, in Missouri and in Kansas.
We'd love to see you in Kansas City. Bill, thank you so much for the information, and thank you so much for talking with us and bringing these characters
to us.
Have a good day. And that's all for this last part of the Heartland Labor Forum. Stay tuned for Safety First.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sick of the safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Hello, this is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, USDA to allow raising line speeds from the Confined Space newsletter at jordanbarab.com/confined space for September 27th. The Department of Agriculture published a notice September 26th on the Federal Register that would raise line processing speeds at certain poultry plants, raising the already high likelihood that poultry plant workers will suffer from disabling musculoskeletal disorders. Just to add insult to physical injury, USDA issued the notice without seeking public input. Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat, Connecticut, is not amused. It is unconscionable that the Trump administration would rush this process without ample opportunity for the public to weigh in. I urge the Trump administration to reverse course. This action has been under consideration for a while. DeLauro joined Senator Patty Murray, Democrat, Washington, in sending a letter to USDA last July, stating it appears the agency lacks the authority to grant these waivers and urged the agency to abandon the policy. According to Politico's Morning Shift, the policy establishes criteria to allow poultry plants to receive waivers to raise line speeds from 140 to 175 birds per minute. We are stunned they are not doing this through rulemaking or requesting any comments, said Debbie Berkowitz, a former policy advisor at OSHA who's now with the National Employment Law Project. Next, OSHA begins regional emphasis program on ammonia fertilizer. From www.osha.gov, OSHA press release for September 25th, a three-month period of education and outreach to employers about the hazards of fertilizer-grade ammonium nitrate, or FGAN, and agricultural anhydrous ammonia began October 1st, OSHA announced. The educational outreach is part of a new regional emphasis program targeting fertilizer storage, mixing, blending, and distribution industries in the states of Arkansas, Kansas, Louisiana, Missouri, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas. Workers in this industry face hazards that include fire, explosions, exposure to toxic gases, and hazardous chemicals. Following this period, OSHA will engage in enforcement activities related to FGAN and anhydrous ammonia through September 30, 2019. The OSHA website provides guidance to the fertilizer industry on the storage of and use of ammonia nitrate. At least 40 tons of FGAN was present at the West Fertilizer Facility in West Texas when it exploded in April 2013. The blast killed 12 first responders, three members of the public, caused more than 260 injuries, destroyed the storage facility, and damaged more than 150 additional buildings. In May 2016, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms announced that the fire had been deliberately set. That theory has come under criticism from arson safety experts and legal representatives of the victims of the explosion, since the announcement was based on negative findings for any other cause. OSHA's creation of the Regional Emphasis Program meets one of the Chemical Safety Board's recommendation for improving safety at fertilizer storage facilities, found at www.csb.gov. The CSB also recommended updating the OSHA Process Safety Management Standard as well as Explosive and Blasting Agents Standard for ammonium nitrate storage. Is that likely to happen in the near future? Finally, a safer direction, top mine regulator, addresses concerns about deaths and deaths in coal. From WOUB.org for September 21st. As President Trump attempts to revise the struggling coal industry, the administration's top regulator for mine safety used a recent lecture at West Virginia University to lay out his priorities for the agency charged with keeping miners safe. Assistant Secretary of Labor for Mine Safety and Health, David Zaitzolo, outlined the Trump administration's priority for the Mine Safety and Health Administration. The West Virginia native and former coal mine executive addressed students, faculty, and industry representatives at the annual William Poundstone Lecture Series at West Virginia University. Zaitzolo said told the crowd the agency intends to use technology to reduce mining fatalities and injuries. But while the agency head offered numerous possible ways technology could help reduce mechanical deaths and fatalities, he presented no plan to address one of the industry's biggest growing concerns, exposure to coal and rock dust behind a surge in black lung disease. Once nearly eradicated, black lung is now a public health epidemic in central Appalachia. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Lefties Hangout is every Saturday night for lefties. And if you're interested, it's a social event, and of course there's political discussion. If you're interested, email heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com for the location. It will not be meeting this Saturday because of the Trump demonstration in Topeka. CWA rally against monopoly mergers, Friday, October 5th, 10:30 a.m. That's tomorrow morning, 10:30 a.m., on the Sprint campus, and I'm sorry we don't have a more specific address. T-Mobile's CEO is going to be in town. Still Separate, Still Unequal, Pursuing Racial Justice in Kansas. That's also tomorrow, October 5th, from 8:30 to 3 p.m. at Kansas City, Kansas Community College, 7250 State Avenue, KCK. It's a conference sponsored by the Kansas ACLU. Mayoral Debate, Town Hall, October 6th. Find out who's a candidate. UMKC Law School, 500 East 52nd Street. Excuse me. Protest Trump's Topeka Rally for Kobach. Saturday, October 6th, 5 p.m. at the Topeka Expo Center, 1 Expo Center Drive, Topeka, Kansas. Rally against postal privatization. October 8th, Monday, 10 a.m. to noon at Union Station, sponsored by the postal unions, the American Postal Workers, the National Association of Letter Carriers, the Mail Handlers, and the Rural Letter Carriers. And canvass Saturdays or Sundays with Jobs with Justice for the upcoming elections through October. Call Jobs with Justice at 816-423-1507. That's it for our calendar. You can find our calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, along with our archived shows and our upcoming schedule. Tune in next week. Our show is going to be about two books about the decline of work and the middle class. One is called Gigged, The End of the Job and the Future of Work, and the other is called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.